Good morning to all our retired and current DCI employees. My name is David Collins, former director at DCI. I'm joined here today with former DCI director Gary Hamlin. This is another of our continuing podcasts to highlight and document some of our former and current colleagues' service and experiences over their careers. Just a bit of background to our listeners. DCI was created in 1964 with four special agents and one chief special agent, and they were under that then was called the Attorney General's Office. And from our famous quote-unquote responsibilities to investigate crime, which is statewide in nature, importance, and influence. Then in 1967, the Wisconsin Department of Justice was formed under the Attorney General's Office, and DCI was a division in DOJ. It was built from transferring staff and program from the Department of Taxation and the Insurance Commissioner's Office. In 1969, DCI received authority to investigate drug and organized crime cases. Then in 1975, alcohol and tobacco enforcement program was transferred back to the Department of Revenue. And then gambling and prostitution enforcement responsibilities remained with DCI. And then of another note, the Division of Narcotics Enforcement existed between 1990 and 2003. So moving on to our guest, Gary Hamlin. Gary, just a real quick thumbnail sketch of your career, starting when you started in law enforcement to when you retired.
Sure, Dave. I started in law enforcement in 1967. Started out as the acting undersheriff of Sawyer County. Worked there, and I went back to school in the fall, graduated from University of Wisconsin at Eau Claire. And then in 1968, in the summer of 68, interviewed with what was then the Wisconsin Department of Taxation for the beverage tax division. Was hired in November of 1968. At that time, it was then a part of the Department of Justice. Worked in the in DCI until 1997, I believe it was, at which time I was appointed sheriff of Dane County. Served as sheriff of Dane County for approximately 10 years, and then decided not to seek another term, and was hired by the Department of Justice to be the administrator of the Division of Law Enforcement Services. I did that for 4 years, and was going to retire at the end of the four-year term, and was then asked to take over the Wisconsin Department of Corrections, and I served as the Secretary of the Department of Corrections for 2 years before finally retiring in 2012.
Okay. Fantastic, interesting career. So now we're going to get into a little few of the details. First of all, Gary, I'd like to kind of going back to where you grew up, the county, the city, and then I'm not going to go into it. I'll let you go to the details. An interesting story of how you got to become undersheriff and how you got connected with the sheriff's department. So go ahead.
Yeah, it was interesting, and it's kind of ironic. I grew up in Hayward, was always interested in law enforcement. I went to the Wisconsin State University at Eau Claire. They did not have a law enforcement program of any kind, but they had sociology with a kind of a work experience in law enforcement. So I took that that route. While I was at Eau Claire, I joined the Eau Claire County Sheriff's Reserve. They had a reserve force at that time. So received just a thumbnail sketch of training, I guess. I'm not sure if we do even call it training by today's standards. But then the summer of 67, I returned home. I had been working throughout high school and college at a furniture store, appliance store. Learned a lot about all sorts of things, electrical work and that sort of thing. But one morning I was at the store and the sheriff stopped in. Sheriff stopped in and asked, he says, "You're interested in law enforcement, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, I am." He says, "How would you like to be the acting undersheriff of Sawyer County for the next 3 months?" He says, "My undersheriff had a heart attack and is going to be out of work for 3 months." And so I thought about that for maybe half a second or so, and I said, "Sure, I'll do that." So the next day, I was the acting undersheriff of Sawyer County, which placed me number two in the department, counting from both the top and the bottom, because there were three of us there. And ironically, the sheriff at the time was a woman. It was actually the former sheriff's wife. In 1967, sheriffs could only serve two terms. If they were popular, they would often either have an arrangement with the chief deputy or undersheriff, who would then run in an alternating term, or in a number of cases, the sheriff's wife ran. And in Sawyer County in 1967, it was the sheriff's wife that was the sheriff. So although she was not an active law enforcement officer, her husband was an unpaid deputy, so he was one of the officers. I was the other one, and excuse me, we had one traffic officer who also, about a month after I was there, injured his back, so there was two of us for the summer. And in the 1960s, the Sawyer County area around Hayward was a very popular tourist area, and so the summer population would really increase. And in addition to the tourism, we also had, excuse me, the LCO reservation was located in Sawyer County. And so it presented a lot of opportunities for law enforcement experience, I can put it that way. And it was a great time, had a lot of support both on the reservation and throughout the community. But also, I want to point out that at that time, one of the most popular television shows was the Andy Griffith Show. And so all of my friends didn't have the respect I thought they should have. They referred to me as Barney and kept asking me if I had my bullet. So it got to the point where I carried a bullet in my shirt pocket so I could show them that I had a bullet if they asked. But the interesting part was that back in 1967, there was no required training for law enforcement. No standards whatsoever. So one day I was delivering furniture and appliances. The next day I was the undersheriff and absolutely no training. I can't imagine that happening in this day and age.
No.
But it was a tremendous experience.
So what was the key that got you from the sheriff's department, your interest in the Department of Revenue, to a revenue agent? How did you make that connection and that decision?
At that time, there were two at that time, beverage tax agents living in Hayward. Bud Smith was one, and Ernie Smith was the other. I was introduced to Bud Smith by a neighbor, and he talked very favorably about the beverage tax enforcement unit at the time. Sounded very interesting. Bud introduced me to Ernie Smith, who became a very good friend over the years. And the two of them encouraged me to apply, helped me with the preparations for testing and what to expect and that sort of thing. And I think both gave good recommendations and was subsequently hired as a result of their assistance, I think.
So, Gary, you told me that when you applied for and were hired under Department of Taxation, but you came in about the time they were merging those responsibilities. How did that all go?
Well, it was a little bit confusing for somebody coming from the outside, but it was the time of the Kellett reorganization of state government. And when the interview process took place, would have been sometime in the summer of 1968, as I recall, the interview took place in the Department of Taxation offices, which were in 1 West Wilson Street at that time. So I had the interview there, but subsequently, by November, when I was actually hired, I was hired at the Department of Justice, reported the state capitol to the Attorney General's office. And so that transition took place sometime between the interview in the summer and November when I was hired.
And so at that time, all of DOJ was under the Attorney General's office and in the capitol.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. To the best of my knowledge, I know we were sitting in a side room in the capitol.
I recall, even today, in the Attorney General's office, I haven't been in there in a while, there's a back room that actually has got a high filing cabinet system almost to the ceiling, and there's a ladder on a railing that goes back and forth, and that used to be the record center for the Department of Justice.
Yep. Everything was located within the Attorney General's office there.
Okay. So you come over. Anybody else hired with you?
There were five other agents hired at that time. Chuck Lalinski, Sean Riley, Gerald Egner,
You're just like
Frank,
I was.
Frank Standish was the other one, and I myself. There were five of us.
Yeah. I couldn't remember the sixth name of my name when Denny when I was interviewed a week ago or so ago. So you started, and again, one more time, you showed up at what location then for your first office?
First office was, at that time, we could work out of our home. So I actually worked out of my home. I was hired as a, what they called an inspector. In the beverage tax division. Beverage tax was still part, the functions were the same. It was just moved to the Department of Justice. But beverage tax was kind of a, I guess, a remnant or a carryover from Prohibition days. And when there was a, the tax was imposed on alcohol and cigarettes, initially there was a lot of counterfeiting of taxes, sale of untaxed liquor and tobacco. And so the department was charged with enforcing that kind of tax law. So my role was a an inspector. We'd go into any place that had either a Class A or Class B liquor or beer license, check the licenses, check the inventory of liquor and tobacco, and the primary purpose to make sure that the tax had been paid on anything that was being sold in those establishments.
So, and your first supervisor was?
Guy by the name of Gordon Shaka.
Okay.
Very nice man. Enjoyed working for him. Very fair. Very knowledgeable.
Correct me if I'm wrong. This was there still a chemist lab that DOJ ran, or was that already?
I think the chemist was already at the state crime laboratory.
Okay. All right.
One of the things that we checked for when we checked taverns was to see if people were either watering down their liquor or refilling bottles or whatever. It was typical if people were struggling in the liquor business that sometimes the bottle that was supposed to contain the top shelf brand didn't. And so we would take samples of that and send it into a lab and they would analyze that.
Some of the retirees I've talked to over the years talked about when the Department of Taxation was in the Wilson Street office mm-hmm. building, they had a full chemist lab there, yep. and there were one or two Department of Taxation state chemists.
Yes, there were a couple of them were very colorful individuals,
yes.
yes, they did. But I think that by the time it became the Department of Justice, that function was moved to the state crime laboratory.
So when you started with the other inspectors, mm-hmm. A couple of things. First of all, what sort of training did you receive?
It was pretty much on-the-job training. I was partnered with another inspector, Frank Beck. Lived in Spring Green, and I worked with Frank for a number of months and would just shadow him and go through various inspections with him and worked in his area of the state. He had pretty much the southwest corner of the state of Wisconsin. I was assigned to the west central part up around Eau Claire, Chippewa Falls, all the way to the Mississippi. Coming out of college, I had the distinction of being able to tell my college classmates that I had been in every tavern in west central Wisconsin, and some of them multiple times. But I worked with Frank. And then in December of 1969, my training stopped. I was a member of the Wisconsin Army National Guard, and I left in September of 69, shortly after I was hired. I had worked with Frank for a few weeks, and then I went on active duty for the National Guard and didn't return until December of 1969. When I came back in December of 69, I worked with Frank Beck for a period of time, and then I worked with Ernie Smith for a number of weeks, and then... After that was placed on my own.
Okay. Then, and if I'm jumping too far ahead, let me know, but one of the things that I've never had a good timeline on is when the merger occurred, when they formed the Department of Justice, there were different levels of inspectors. The theory was to get to be a special agent, and
yes.
you had to take tests, and there was competition. And one of the things some people told me, Attorney General Bob Warren recognized this, or even maybe other men, is there was kind of a hierarchy that sometimes wasn't conducive to good working relationships. Mm-hmm. And we're like, well, you're just an inspector and mm-hmm. I'm a special agent. So there was a process they got from how you were in different titles to finally it was just special agent. Do you have any
recall on that? I started out as I believe it was called an investigator, and then there was an agent level, as I recall, and then the special agent level. And then after that, it was supervisors. But the distinction, and that excluded the fire marshal. The fire marshals, which came over as part of the reorganization, were completely separate. They were always fire marshals. But I think that was a tax, started out, I believe, as a tax investigator. Then there was an agent level and then a special agent level. In some cases, there wasn't a lot of overlap between working together. I mean, I think probably in the latter part of, probably been the early part of 1970, they started getting involved in more drug cases. And so as an investigator, I worked with some of the agents then on drug cases, mostly just making arrests, doing raids in West Central Wisconsin.
One of the things that when I talked to people like Ernie, when he was still around, and Skip Belsner, Ernie Smith, I should mm-hmm. say, is they talked about when it came time to either go to the agent position or the special agent, there was a test that provided. And there was a lot of stress. You'd have a pit in your stomach. And then you'd finally say, you know what? I'm just as good of an investigator as that person who's out there doing it. Well, I'm going to take the test and I'm going to compete for it.
Sure. There was a test. I know that Ernie took the test and Skip was already an agent. I think he became a special agent. I took the test in 1970. By 1970, I had kind of tired of doing tavern inspections, and I had asked for something a little more challenging. Late 1970, well, it was early 1970 now that I think about it, because I was getting married, and I was sent to Milwaukee to work an undercover assignment with special agents and agents out of the Milwaukee office. So I did that for a number of months.
At that time, there was obviously the Milwaukee office and obviously headquarters in Madison. Were there any official field offices other than Milwaukee?
Just Milwaukee and Madison were the two offices.
Otherwise, you were in your home.
Worked out of your home. The inspectors worked out of their home. Agents that still did some of the undercover work in taverns worked out of their home. They would meet and go to assigned areas, but they didn't have a regional office. Fire marshals, I think, worked out of their homes yet. So the only two offices were Milwaukee and
so
Madison.
So in 1970, were there actual bureaus?
There were. I think the tavern inspection was part of the enforcement bureau. I don't remember if they called it a fire marshals bureau. It may have been a fire marshals bureau. And then there was an intelligence bureau. The intelligence bureau was consisted of the five original special agents, and that was the intelligence bureau. When I went to Milwaukee to work undercover, there started to be a greater interaction between the intelligence bureau and the agents because they were using agents for some of the undercover work. Special agents were directing it. There were the five. They started to change a little bit, and I took that test to be a special agent in 1970, managed to pass the test, and was sent to Milwaukee in 1971.
So do you recall a ballpark what year they started when you came on, everybody was a special agent? They no longer had any other, probably the mid-70s or...
Probably, yeah. So I'm trying to think. It probably would have been probably the mid-70s.
I recall a few years ago I went through some old memos that were put out by Attorney General Bob Warren, probably in 69 or so, and one of the things it was the creation of Dicker, DCI records. And at that time, and I think I mentioned that in my podcast, is there used to be almost three different intelligence. There was the insurance commissioners / fire marshals records.
Yep.
There were revenue or taxation records that were, and some of them hadn't even been moved over. You had to actually query if you wanted a CNIL report. It had to go over and research it. Somebody did in revenue. And then DCI, and he realized that those, I think he even called them stovepipes of intelligence.
Really?
It needs to be under one. Do you have any recall of that?
I have a vague recall. I moved to Milwaukee in 1971 and worked out of the Milwaukee office. And I remember that the fire marshals had their own records still at that time. And while everything else was headquartered in Madison, the chief fire marshal was located in Milwaukee. So if the insurance commissioner records, the old fire marshal records, were still in Milwaukee. Everything else was housed in Madison, although in Milwaukee we kept copies of every report that we generated. So Milwaukee had their own record system for their records, and then duplicates were filed in Madison.
Do you recall who was the chief fire marshal or the state fire marshal at that time?
I can see him.
Would it have been Kermit?
Nope, that was before Kermit. It was Bill Rossiter.
Okay, I've heard that name.
Bill Rossiter was the chief fire marshal, right. Yes.
So it's now you're in a special agent position, and you're doing what type of cases?
In 71, when I went to Milwaukee, they had created bureaus at that time, and I was assigned to the Organized Crime Bureau. We had the Organized Crime Bureau, the General Investigations Bureau, the Arson Bureau. Those may have been the three. I don't think the Narcotics Bureau was formed until possibly later than that.
Okay. So at what point were you living where between Madison, Milwaukee, Hayward? Did you make some of those moves with yourself or your family?
I started in Eau Claire, stayed there until would have been January of 1971. I moved to Milwaukee. And then stayed in Milwaukee in the Organized Crime Bureau until a reorganization of DCI, and then I believe it was 1975. I stayed in Milwaukee but was assigned to the General Investigations Bureau, and then stayed there until 1980. And in 1980, I moved to Madison.
And for some of you current DCI employees, especially sworn ranks, that was back in the days where if you were a 25 or 30-year state law enforcement, whether it's DCI, State Patrol, you had a career of, I made many moves.
Yes.
Based
yes.
off of not just promotion, but sometimes just bureaus you wanted to work in or yep. offices. It's a different world we live in now. They try to avoid making people pack up and move their families, and which is probably good. But you talk to anybody, Gary's tenure area, usually it involves lots of moves
lots
across
of moves.
Wisconsin.
Yep.
Okay, so a little bit, too, of what types of equipment you might have had. Everything from undercover vehicles, what was your first vehicle back in the revenue days, to when you went to a state vehicle, what type, some of the equipment, some of the weapons, any recall on the details of that?
Or lack thereof.
Or the lack.
When I started in 1968 and through probably sometime in the 70s, we used our own vehicles. We had to furnish our own vehicle. We got paid a fee for mileage. When I first started, we had each vehicle would furnish a Citizen Band radio. So in 1968, 69, we were operating with Citizen Band radios.
So you could talk with your partner a whopping block or two away when you were going to go undercover.
Or a trucker going by.
Or a trucker going, okay. Go ahead.
We used our own vehicles. I remember making an arrest in Milwaukee. This would have been in the 70s before we had any kind of state vehicle. And I remember it distinctly because the fellow that we were arresting was a leader of a what would be called a prostitution ring, had been charged with kidnapping, sexual assault, a host of serious charges. And we got word, we had a warrant for him, got word that he was at a particular restaurant in Milwaukee. So we were going to go, and I got called out from home to go down and just stake out the place. And so I remember at the time, my wife had a small Opel Kadett car, and I thought, I'll be able to stake out in that, and it won't be obvious, because I drove a Ford that looked similar to some of the squads that the city of Milwaukee was using. I thought, well, I'll take the Opel Kadett. And so I got downtown, and I was able to park across from where the suspect's vehicle was. I found it on one of the side streets, and so I sat in my Opel Kadett, and somebody else was watching the front of a restaurant, and they said he's coming toward his car. His was a Cadillac Eldorado. And I remember sitting in the car, seeing him come toward the car, and no backup or anybody else around. But I thought, you know, that Eldorado is not going to be a match for my Opel, or my Opel's not going to be a match for the Eldorado. So at the time, I think we just had a portable radio. I was able to talk to the other folks that were conducting the surveillance. But, you know, had he tried to get away, I would have had to try and stop him with an Opel Kadett, and I didn't think that was going to work very well. So I ended up getting out and making the arrest. Fortunately, it went well. But again, none of the vehicles were equipped with red lights or sirens or anything. And I had the guy against the car, and he had a girlfriend on the other side. I couldn't see her hands very well. I was a little bit anxious about that. And I'm waiting and waiting, and nobody's coming. And finally, the backup shows up. They got stuck in traffic, but without any kind of emergency equipment, mark squads or anything else, there was no way for them to get through. But those were the types of situations that we dealt with when we used essentially our own equipment.
And it's amazing. I mean, in the standards of today, we're lucky that you and your partners made it through those years.
Yeah.
Do you recall your first weapon from revenue and then into DCI?
I think the first weapon was a .38 special, five shot, I think.
Okay. And any other type of equipment? I got to ask, especially if you're a revenue inspector, typewriter for the in the trunk or in your home?
We had a typewriter, yes, and.
Liquor reports.
They provided the typewriter, and then you created all the reports using onion skin or carbon, which, doing a hunt and peck method. I remember one time I made a number of arrests or referrals anyway for people that were selling cigarettes without a license. Apparently, I think it was one whole community. They just stopped issuing cigarette licenses or people stopped applying for them. I'm not sure which. So I was going to cite every one. Well, it took me a week. I ended up north. My in-laws had a place on a lake, and I ended up there with my typewriter sitting there hunting and pecking out. I don't know. It must have been 20-some referrals. And then, of course, each time you make a mistake, then you got to have to change it on the onion skin and things like that. So it was quite an adventure.
It's called operating at the speed of typewriters.
Yes. Not electric typewriters either.
So the training that you, and we talked a little bit about, came on. Did you have any additional, like everything from in-service training to any special schools you were sent to during your first few years as an inspector and as a special agent?
No, during the first few years, we would have annual in-service. I think I've been semi-annual, twice a year. I think we had an in-service training in the spring and fall, and that would generally be focused on any changes in liquor law violations. We would do some training exercises. Never had the formal training of you would be from that version of a police academy until 1970s. We went to the Madison Police Department for a 4-week police academy. Unfortunately, that was my two-week National Guard encampment took place during that 4 weeks, so I only got to 2 weeks of that training. But we would have the in-service training that would focus on certain things when it was the beverage tax. I think once we got to became more a part of the DCI, I think it became more of an annual in-service training, but it focused on some of the changes in the law. We would do firearms training, some of those types of things. I remember one training we had, still back when we were focused on enforcing some of the liquor laws, we did a exercise where we tried to find a still on a farm, and it had been set up as a training program. And I remember crawling across the farm field on my stomach to get close to the farm, thinking, I'm never going to do this, be out here crawling through the dark. I think the training ended on Friday. That Friday afternoon, I had gone down with Ernie Smith. That afternoon, they called Ernie and said there was a suspected house of prostitution. And wanted Ernie and another agent to go and investigate that, and I would stake it out from the outside. So not 24 hours after that training, I was crawling on my stomach through the woods up so I could get outside of this house of ill repute, and turned out we didn't make a case that night, but that training materialized into something real very quickly. But we had those types of things, and I think but the formal training actually would be considered the equivalent of today's police academy didn't happen until the 1970s sometime.
It's interesting you mentioned about revenue inspectors and agent training. One of the things I remember from Skip Belsner that gave me, and actually it's at the D.C. offices now, is a 1963 Department of Taxation policy and procedure. Mm-hmm. And obviously it was developed in the 20s, 30s, 40s, mm-hmm. and 50s, back in Prohibition, yep. where stills were a big thing. Yep. Investigating, there's actually sections in there that tells you and trains you in policy-wise and procedure how to hide in a haystack of loose hay mm-hmm. and how to hide in a haystack of bale hay. And there's a difference of, if you're going to stake out there for hours, how to figure out what fence line to be along out of the wind and that you were going to lay there for 12 hours waiting for them. And you look at the details and some of the issues. It was probably all developed off of real life. The challenges in which you had a little bit of experience in.
I think probably some older people could go through and put names next to some of those things, yes.
Okay, so now we're getting into the mid-70s. Who would have been the administrator at that time?
Frank Myers was the administrator in the mid-70s, yeah.
And you were in what a lot of us look at now is my time was general investigations mm-hmm. or special assignments, homicides, any homicides that you worked on that have come to note?
Yeah, I worked on a number of them. The one that that's sticks in my mind most. Actually, I worked on before I was assigned to the Special or General Investigations Bureau. I was still assigned to the White Collar or the Organized Crime Bureau in Milwaukee. But there had been an Illinois police officer that disappeared on the interstate in Illinois. And all they found was his squad on the side of the interstate, lights flashing, and no trace of the officer whatsoever. And back in those days, the radio traffic was such in the Chicago area that he had called in a stop, but because of the radio traffic, nobody was able to discern who he was stopping or any license numbers or anything like that. That happened in, I believe it was the fall. It had been 9 months. He had disappeared. Just no trace of him whatsoever, no information. Somebody in Illinois started to get some informant information, I think out of the Illinois prison system. It was the Illinois Crime Commission, I think, was getting some information that a particular group of people that were known to be committed armed robberies and other violent crimes may have had something to do with it. And they determined that one of the leaders of that group, his family had a couple of farms in northern Wisconsin, or a farm in northern Wisconsin. And the information from the informant was that this policeman had been killed and buried on this farm in northern Wisconsin. So in June of the following year, this had been probably 9 months afterwards, and all sorts of rumors were circulating that maybe the guy had an affair and ran off and just used this as a guise to disappear. Those rumors were swirling, but they developed informant information that he may be buried on this farm in northern Wisconsin. And in June, the Illinois State Police, Cook County Sheriff's Office, it was the Oneida County, Wisconsin Sheriff's Office, DCI, started a search of this farm in northern Wisconsin. It was about an 80-acre farm. Searched the farm for a week, going shoulder to shoulder and across all sorts of fields through the barn, and it generated some humorous things, too. I remember going through the barn with the lieutenant from Cook County Sheriff's Office. We turned over a hay bale, and there was a snake coiled up under the hay bale. It was just like a cartoon. The sheriff's lieutenant went right out the haymow door in midair, and I wish today I had a film of that. But to get back to the story, we had searched the whole week. We were down to the last day that we were going to, do it one more day, and then we'll just have to wait for more information. But we sat around talking and speculated that there ended up being two farms, and on the road into one of the farms there was a hollow alongside the road. So I thought, well, maybe you just stopped and rolled them down the hill and buried them there. So we went out that morning, went over to that spot. It was actually a hollow on both sides. We searched the spot on one side of the road and didn't find anything. Went to the other side of the road, started walking through, and all we had to probe with at the time was I had a shovel, a regular number two spade, and came to one spot, and you're just kind of sticking the shovel in the ground to see if, everything's root bound, so you were kind of hoping that you found a spot that wasn't. And sure enough, I hadn't gone too terribly far, and I put the shovel in the ground, and it went in pretty easy. And I turned over the first shovel of dirt, and I could see that there were leaves mixed in with the sand and the stuff. And there was a Oneida County detective next to me, and I said, "Charlie, I think I've got something." And he came over and got down with the sands, and we started pulling back the dirt. And the first thing we uncovered was the badge of the police officer. So I think I made a believer out of a lot of us, because I know for a fact there were a lot of prayers said the last night before we finished that search, and we found them. Subsequently, the people responsible were charged, convicted, and died in prison.
I'm so glad you mentioned that case, Gary. First of all, that's one of the most emotional cases I've ever read, and I've read it over because it'll lead me into kind of a connected thing I want to speak about is the DCI Death Investigation School. You'd mentioned you'd worked there, I think, with Ernie Smith also, mm-hmm. and if I remember right, correct me if I'm wrong, the Illinois officer assigned to that, I don't recall if at that time he was a state police agent or whether he was a local agency's mm-hmm. detective, became very good friends with Ernie.
Yeah, he was,
and ended up becoming director of the Illinois State Police and actually spoke at Ernie's retirement party.
Yeah, he was at the time, I think it was called the Illinois Bureau of Investigation, IBI, and it was not part of the state police. I think eventually IBI became part of the state police, and he was the director of the Illinois State Police. Yep.
When I went down to wiretap school, he was the director, and I used to room with him.
Yep.
And he had a place in his heart, not only for Wisconsin, for DCI, for you, for Ernie. And if I also recall, that case was utilized as a training case for the Death Investigation School. Ernie developed that as part of the Identification of Human Remains mm-hmm. Class. And that case was a case study in that training class. And I can remember seeing those slides of that badge. And Ernie said part of the reason, too, he believes that, when the spade went down, and I'm not saying you struck the badge directly, but behind the badge was a pocket Bible. Mm. And it was enough, firm enough that that's kind of what your spade probably mm-hmm. met and gave you the inclination to keep digging. You were probably with Charlie, who ended up being Crowfoot.
Charlie Crowfoot was.
Yep, ended up being sheriff, I believe, later.
Yep.
Great group of people from Oneida County. And you also, I've got to recall, it was right near the edge of private property owned by a paper company, right?
It may have been. I know it was not on the farm. It was not on the farm where the informant information was suggesting and the body would be, but it was on a road leading into the farm. So it may have been, there's a lot of paper company for us. I don't recall right offhand.
So that leads me into, again, DCI starting to work some homicide cases, mm-hmm. very successfully high-profile cases, challenging techniques. So there's a decision to make. Russ Nelson's idea, the bureau director, to have a death investigation school. What was your involvement in that, and what's your recall on that?
I remember when he started, I think that would probably have been 1977, I think, may have been.
76, 77.
And he started talking about having a death investigation school, and most of the agents in DCI were relatively humble people. I mean, they did their work and worked hard and were well-liked by law enforcement around the state, the people that assisted in those investigations, but thought that, you know, who are we to be teaching somebody else how to do an investigation? But Russ was insistent that, you know, collectively we had the experience that we could share and should share with law enforcement throughout the state. And so he created the Death Investigation School.
You were one of the first instructors?
I was. There were a number of instructors, Ernie Smith, myself, Harry Engelbart, Rick Lew. I don't know if Rick was there at that time or became shortly after, but started that, did that school, and it was extremely well received.
Do you remember some of the classes, for the titles of the classes you taught?
Death by Sharp Force Injury was
that
one
was
of them.
Okay.
Sexually Motivated Murders, I believe, was another one that I I instructed in. I think I had maybe three or four.
And it was a two-week school back then.
It was a two-week school held at the American Baptist Center in Green Lake. Again,
two sessions, one in the spring, one in the fall?
Yep, exactly. And one, there was a waiting list for people to get in, and it did good things all the way around. I mean, it provided a lot of information for local law enforcement, a lot of experience. Also created tremendous ties between DCI and local law enforcement throughout the state. Eventually, almost every department in the state of any size at all that could send somebody to that had at least one person trained at the Death Investigation School. And just opened lines of communication, made working with, you know, the working relationship between state and local agencies throughout the state just improved it tremendously. You know, at one time, it's fair to say that not every local agency welcomes state agents for a variety of reasons. Sometimes it's just not having the knowledge of who they are, not having a working relationship, but that just improved that tremendously over the years.
One of the things that it reminds me of, for those listeners who worked with Gary back in the 70s, I remember seeing a great photo of you in front of the classroom teaching at Green Lake Death Investigation School with that classic handlebar mustache. No one had a better mustache than Gary did. Back in the day, before the days of from some of you people from the 80s, Raleigh Fingers from the pitcher from
Milwaukee
Brewers. Gary's was 10 times better than Raleigh Fingers.
I went to a Raleigh Fingers look-alike contest because of the mustache. But yeah.
Well, maybe this is a good time for us here to take a short break, and we'll be back in a few minutes and with Gary Hamlin. Welcome back, everyone, to our podcast for DCI. Again, with us is Gary Hamlin, former director of DCI. I just thought I'd take a quick moment to mention that case that Gary was just talking about of the Illinois police officer that was killed in Illinois and his body was buried and later discovered by DCI special agents and local law enforcement in northern Wisconsin. That was Patrolman Anthony Raymond from the Hillside Police Department, Illinois. And again, this was a 1972 case in which he was missing, and then later on finding his body in Oneida County. Again, for any of you that want to hear a little bit of detail of that case and of Patrolman Anthony Raymond, you can go to Law Enforcement Line of Duty Death and just Google it, or there's a site that gives you a rundown of the officer, the incident of how it occurred, and then how they developed the suspects in a little bit more detail that I won't go into right here, but that was probably a pivotal case for how important DCI is for working statewide in multi-jurisdictional agency cases. And Gary was very fortunate to be assigned to that case, and we're very fortunate he was able to share that details with us. It was very interesting, Gary. So we're at the point in your career in general investigations. From there, where did you move in DCI for your in various positions?
After being a special agent in DCI, I became the administrative officer for DCI. That must have been about 1985, maybe somewhere.
A little before.
No, excuse me, 1980.
1980.
I moved to Madison in 1980.
Gary, for those who didn't hear the last podcast that I did a few weeks ago, Gary is one of several people I have to thank for getting onto DCI, and you heard that story before, but Gary will always be near and dear to my heart in his role of his administrative officer, making that phone call to set up my interview in 1980. But go ahead, Gary.
Yeah. So that was an extremely interesting position. I was responsible for budgeting for the division, training for the division, recruitment, and hiring, and those types of things. We had a division training officer. I was responsible for all of the administrative support, the clerical support, provided a tremendous bit of experience on how government works and got me a little bit removed from law enforcement, although being involved in the training and that part kept me in touch, but provided a great deal of administrative experience, enjoyed working with Frank Myers, the division administrator. Frank was extremely helpful, and we became very good friends during that time. We had a great group of directors. John Killian was the director of the narcotics, I think it was called at that time, Narcotics and Vice Bureau. Phil Culp was in charge of the Arson Bureau. Skip Belsner in charge of white-collar crime, and Russ Nelson in charge of general investigations. It was for me, a fun time, a very enjoyable experience within DCI.
And also under you, your responsibilities was Dicker, D-C-I-R.
D-C-I-R.
And the supervisor was?
Ann Rolsey was a supervisor at the time. I think Ann eventually moved on, and Donna Strand became a supervisor. So we just had excellent people all the way around. We were extremely fortunate to have a tremendous support staff, people that just did a yeoman's job of supporting agents in the field and getting things done.
One of the things, Gary, I recall, and I mentioned it in my podcast interview, was back when Don Hanaway became Attorney General, we had a review of all the DCI operations. So we split up into committees, assigned agents to review. So one of the things I had to do was to review what Dicker does or whatever. And I remember interviewing the six or seven or eight that were in Dicker, all of them said, when you ask what's your prime responsibility, the first response was the safety of the special agents. Mm-hmm. And so the question was to me a few weeks ago was, how did they learn that? I said, I'm guessing they got it from people like Ann Ralsei and Gary Hamlin, who did some sort of training when we would hire a Dicker analyst in, and that they would learn their job and they would also get some guidance on what it is that they do. And somewhere, someone instilled upon all of them the importance of although people just say, well, they're just checking records. Well, they were getting records that could mean the difference of safety or not having safety of the agents in the field.
Absolutely. At that time, you know, I mean, we didn't have the communication tools that are available today. And oftentimes it was a phone call from an agent in the field to Dicker to check names or run checks for them because they were about to, engage with somebody or execute a warrant or who knows what. And Dicker was their only source of information. And so the people there would not only check DCI records, but they could also run records through other agencies, other states, and get that information as well. And for a DCI agent, that was their link to outside information, particularly if they weren't working closely with a local law enforcement agency, which oftentimes circumstances dictated that they weren't for a variety of reasons. So I don't want to say their lifeline, but it was probably the closest thing to a lifeline to outside information that DCI agents had available at the time.
And I recall, Gary, that in Dicker we had card files, and they were on large conveyor belt things where there was basically so many hundreds of cards per tray, and then the tray would rotate around to the next one, and it was all set up by alphabetical. And every time that person's name got indexed in a report over the years, if they were ongoing, like an organized crime, you added that information to the card. And then, obviously to our staff had availability to teletype and phone and communications to other agencies, but that as far as our own records, and then certain current records were kept in that office. And then if you had to go back 10 or 15 years, they were kept at
State Record Center.
Out at the Department of Revenue / crime lab.
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And do you remember kind of were you involved in any of the changes of that? And
not so much. I think that changed more after I was there. It was pretty much a manual system when I was there, computers had not arrived in DCI at that point. So all of those cards that you talk about, those were manual entries. So when a person in DCI would read a report and see a name, it would be up to them to index that name, make sure that it got into the card file, all done manually, and they did a tremendous amount of work.
And I remember it was names, vehicles, and businesses, I think, were the three main areas that we indexed in. Mm-hmm. And so you'd get a report that was 5 pages long. There would be, every time there was a name, business, whatever, it was underlined, and then that was indexed to that report, that page.
Yep.
And so that when you even got the report, you could quickly go to where it was that was mentioned. And it seemed to work very well. It seemed great, but compared to what they have now, it's amazing.
Yes. At the time, that was, you know, when I go back to the early 70s when I worked in Milwaukee and worked in the Organized Crime Bureau, that was the technique for linking people together, is whether or not, you know, you interviewed somebody or did a surveillance and somebody's vehicle showed up at a particular location or whatever. I mean, none of the technology that we have today.
No, that was, there were great times, but it seems like centuries ago,
yes.
Not decades ago. Okay. So you're administrative officer, and what was your next career move?
After that, I think that was 1980 that I moved up. It must have been about 1985, I think. I was appointed as director of the Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs Bureau.
That's right.
I think Vice may have been removed from the name at that point. It was Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs.
I think John Killian went over to special assignments.
John went to the Division of Law Enforcement Services as the administrator.
That's right. John Killian took an appointed division administrator position in DOJ, and then you became the narcotics. That's right. I'd forgotten about that.
Yep.
Go ahead.
So, I did that. I enjoyed that. Narcotics enforcement really wasn't my my forte. Narcotics enforcement, yet today, I think it's almost overwhelming. I kind of felt like we were somehow the little Dutch kid with the finger in the dike. We had agents that did tremendous work. They had a good clerk's working relationship with federal government and with state agencies, MEG units around the state. Did a lot of great things, made a lot of good cases, caused a lot of headaches. There were places in Milwaukee, I remember, that we knocked down a door to get in, and then I would get a call from the special agent in charge that the door was one of those nice molded oak doors with the round, you know, so we weren't just replacing it with a hardware door. It was, we were paying substantial amounts of money, but that's what needed to be done. I think while I was there, when I first started with DCI and we did drug investigations, they were primarily marijuana cases. And that was considered a serious drug case. It just got worse and worse. We had agents, to this day, admire the work that they did, because they're, you know, out at all hours of the day and night. You see some of those things have stuck with me forever. When you do early morning search warrants and you see the living conditions, for example, that some children are being raised in, that part has influenced a lot of my thinking and activities ever since then. So, in that respect, it was a valuable experience. By then we had offices in Milwaukee, Madison, Eau Claire, and Appleton. All four of those offices were doing very good work, and unfortunately the problem was all over the state.
And you had special agent supervisors?
Yes.
Back then we called them RSs,
regional supervisors. Yes. Yeah, regional supervisor in each office, just for narcotics and dangerous drugs. The other bureaus were still headquartered located in either Madison or Milwaukee. So the Appleton and the Eau Claire office, it was Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, and the fire marshal for that region was based in those offices. We still had a couple of fire marshals working out of their home in far northern Wisconsin.
And help me on my recall, about that 85 time, it would have been Dan Hughes is the regional supervisor in Appleton. Ron Ninneman was in Eau Claire. Dick Larson was in Milwaukee. And Tom Steingraber was in
Madison. Yeah. Yep.
Okay. So you were in narcotics for as a director for a certain time. Where did that lead you to?
I was in narcotics as the director until the Bureau of Narcotics, or the Division of Narcotics Enforcement, was formed in, what was that, 1990? Excuse me. And at that time, they brought in a division administrator from California, Eugene Williams. He stayed for maybe 2 years. He left, and shortly after that, I left narcotics and became the first director of the Gaming Enforcement Bureau in DCI.
And I've got to make an apology, Gary, again, on my interview a few weeks ago. I failed to mention that during my time, the Gaming Enforcement Bureau, but now I have the first director of Gaming Bureau that can give us a little more detail on it. So go ahead.
Yeah, the Gaming Enforcement Bureau was created by the legislature when tribal gaming was, when the compacts had been signed with the various tribes in Wisconsin, the 11 tribes, as a means of trying to maintain the integrity of casinos. And when the casinos were first, tribal casinos were first established, the tribes had a hard time getting money. They didn't have the resources, the collateral, legitimate. Traditional banks were reluctant, or financial institutions reluctant to invest in tribal casinos because they didn't have a credit record, a credit history. So the tribes turned to some other outside investors. And there was concern on the part of the state that some of those outside investors may corrupt the gaming process, not only in Wisconsin, but all across the country. The same thing was happening in many other states. And so the Gaming Enforcement Bureau was created largely to help maintain the integrity of gaming, to do background investigations on some of those outside influences. And it was a challenging time for us. Tribal governments, tribal officials were suspicious of state enforcement. The state and federal government doesn't have a real good record when it comes to dealing with tribes across the country and Native Americans as a whole. The old saying, I'm from the state and I'm here to help, didn't go very far in tribal governments, and rightfully so. In order to maintain the integrity of tribal gaming, you had to be able to get inside tribal government and deal with people, the tribes, as well as the entities that were coming in. Our first year or more, we stressed the need to gain the trust of the tribes so that we could work with them and stress that we weren't there to work against them. We were there to help them maintain their interest in tribal gaming. So we spent a lot of time doing that. We had gaming conferences that we held around the state. Had a couple of large ones up in the Green Bay area where we brought in experts from Nevada, New Jersey, other places that have had greater experience with casinos and gaming. We did backgrounds on the entities that were financing and managing some of the casinos. And we built up, a significant amount of trust with the tribes. And I think one of the things that makes me most proud is, we went from never forget, John Palmer and I went to a casino and we wanted to take a look at their surveillance room. Casinos have a tremendous surveillance capability, as they should. And they were reluctant to let us into the surveillance room because we were from the state and supposedly there to help. But we talked our way in and looked at it. So we went from that point of hardly even being allowed in a casino. In fact, prior to the compacts, the tribal police chief from the Menominee Police Department had once threatened that if a DCI agent showed up on the Menominee Reservation, he would have them arrested. The relationships had not gone well. When I left tribal gaming, that would have been in 1997, the last call that I received for assistance from one of the tribes came from the Menominee, a member of the Menominee Tribal Commission, wanting DCI to come and investigate some corruption. They'd had an employee taking kickbacks from a janitorial supply service. And I said, well, that's not really gaming. But they said, well, you know, some of that stuff was being used to clean the casino. I said, well, maybe we can stretch it. But I said, the FBI is the one that is responsible in Menominee County. Menominee is the only tribe in the state that's not part of Public Law 280. So what that means is that any crimes committed on the Menominee Reservation are subject to investigation by the federal authorities. Any of the other reservations fall under state jurisdiction. And but the response I received was that, well, they take a long time, and you guys, I know you'll do a good job, and you'll get it done quickly, and we would rather have you come and do the investigation. And that's a credit to John Palmer and Kira Shellhorn and Jerry Kangas and Dorinda Freimiller, the agents that were actually out doing the work. So I was very proud of the change in relationships between the tribes and DCI. And in the process, learned a tremendous amount about casino gambling. I'm not a gambler myself, but it's a fascinating industry. And I'm happy today that I think that the tribes have done a pretty good job of managing their casinos. The corruption that was feared from outside influences has not materialized. And I think that's been an asset for tribes throughout the state.
You mentioned a word that I used to is trust, you know, that developing trust, building trust, and keeping trust, how important that is for the success of DCI. I can't help but think, though, when you first meet some of these tribal officials as a bureau director, you know, we all do. You talk a little bit about your background. The fact that you were raised in Hayward, I'm guessing, probably went a long ways. I mean, that you know, yes, I have experience with the tribes going back to when I was young, including when you were an undersheriff and a deputy sheriff. And I think they probably saw you as somebody that was close to their way of living and their style in northern Wisconsin. And not that the casinos are only in northern Wisconsin, but a lot of our tribes are. And I would guess that you probably were the right person at the right time that really did help cement a lot of good relationships.
Well, I was honored because when I retired in 1997, I had a typical retirement party, but quite a number of tribal people came to that party, so that made me feel good. That was one of the things I think that it struck me about DCI too is the need, and that's where the Death Investigation School really helped. That's where people like Ernie Smith and Skip Belsner were really an asset, is that they had the ability to form relationships with people all across the state. And I remember being sent to one county in the far north part of the state that had a reputation for maybe lawlessness, particularly during hunting season and that sort of thing, and being sent as a DCI agent up there, and it was very clear we were not welcome, but the district attorney, a newly elected district attorney, had asked for assistance on a homicide case, and by the time we were done, successfully solved the case and received a nice award from that county. So we were able to take that one to, from a place where you're not at all welcome to one that, in fact, I think we were called back there probably three times in a very short period of time for a variety of cases. So developing those relationships is important, and that's where we had some people that did a good job of that.
I can, on a side note, I can remember working a case for you. I was in special assignments, but you had some sort of a major case in Black River at one of the casinos up there. So we teamed up, one DCI agent with one FBI. And we were there for 3 or 4 days, and John Palmer was kind of running it from the field, and you were the director in Madison. And I was assigned with Dick Stadler, God rest his soul. Yeah. He's FBI special agent. I got along with him great. I worked spearfishing with him. I always got assigned to Dick because he requested it, because like Dick, I like to go out and have a nice meal at the end of the day, not a burger at a, you know, go to a supper club and sit down and relax. Well, I'm a non-drinker, and Dick always wanted to team up with me because he knew he had a designated driver. in case he wanted to have a before or after dinner drink. And it was a great, every time there was a need for gaming bureau, Dick and I would always raise our hands and sure, we'll partner up. Yeah. We'll fit together.
Yeah.
So now it's you're in the director's position there. What was the next career move inside or outside of DOJ?
The next move was outside of DOJ in 1997. The then sheriff of Dane County, Rick Ramish, decided to retire midterm in his term. And in Wisconsin, when a sheriff leaves midterm, it's up to the governor to appoint a successor. And so there were a number of people. You were included in that, which I think was a real tribute to DCI. I think I don't know how many people had put their name in, but at least two of us were from DCI and received serious consideration from the governor. I was fortunate enough to get that appointment. You were fortunate enough to stay in DCI and move even higher. But in 97, then I became sheriff of Dane County and served from 97 until the beginning of 2007.
You know, when you talk about trust, you know, obviously, probably even want to do a podcast down the road on your time in both Dane County Sheriff and then eventually to Corrections Secretary. Mm-hmm. Before I get back to the DOJ, I just wanted to say, because you came back to DOJ then, yeah. You talk about that trust. I can remember a couple of different times where you and your chief deputy, Steve Nolan, would call mm-hmm. Frank or me and say, you know, we've got a case of mutual mm-hmm. interest. I won't go into the details of it. And we'd go over to your office about 5 o'clock at night. And it was a high profile. Mm-hmm. And again, having that trust and that friendship on a high profile case for both Dane County Sheriff and for DCI mm-hmm. makes those so much easier to work and so much easier to deal with. Some of the times they're going to be political issues. Because I knew Dane County was going to treat us fairly, and you knew DCI was going to treat yeah. Dane County fairly. Yeah.
That I think that's the thing that's crucial, and I think that's what makes work easier and it makes work more fun when you can have those relationships. And I can't stress enough the importance of those at any level in law enforcement. I mean, particularly in DCI, because I mean, for me, one of the things that was appealing about the Dane County Sheriff's Office was it was a chance to take what I've learned and apply it to my own community. One of the downsides for me from DCI is you go to a community, you work there for a period of time, you get to know people, and then you're back up and you move on to the next one. And you don't really put down roots. You don't have a chance to share things or contribute back to the community. I enjoyed working. I spent time in Hurley, and had an excellent working relationship with the chief deputy, and we exchanged a lot of information. I think I provided a lot of information in the period of time I was there. But then, when the case is over, you're packed up and you're moved. But having those relationships, I can't stress enough how important that is. At every level. I mean, if you're a beat officer or a patrol deputy someplace, having relationships with the community and the people you serve is just extremely important. One of the, talked about my beginning in Sawyer County. I remember going to a bar fight at a dance hall and was located right on the edge of the reservation, the Lacouderie Reservation. But it was in the summertime, and it attracted a lot of tourists and stuff. And it was pretty much a fun place for people to go, and you know, had polka bands and a good time. And like any place, you get somebody that had too much to drink, and they start a fight in the bar. And the first time that happened, I waited in there by myself and managed to get it straightened out, although it wasn't exactly pretty. And there were two Native Americans standing by the bar, and by the time things settled down, they motioned me over. So I went to talk to him, and I said, next time that happens, he says, let us know and we'll be happy to help you out. And they were two nice guys. They worked in the Twin Cities, came back home on the weekend, and they weren't heavy drinkers, but they would just go out and meet some friends. But, you know, from that point on, I realized it's important to make friends in the community. You never know when you're going to need some help. So those relationships are important.
So after 10 years, you decide to not run again as sheriff. So next you were asked to come back to DOJ by Attorney General
Van Hollen.
J.B. Yep. Van Hollen, okay. And yep. So tell us how that went and what you did there.
After 10 years as sheriff, I don't want to say the politics. I'd never been involved in politics before I was a sheriff. It wasn't the partisan politics. It was the county boards and things like that that finally started to wear me down. And so I decided not to run again, and I was eligible to retire. I thought I would retire. Attorney General Van Hollen called and asked if I would become an administrator of law enforcement services. At the time, I thought, well, maybe I could give that a shot. So I did. I accepted the position, enjoyed it tremendously. Then we had part of the law enforcement services included the crime laboratories, the Crime Information Bureau, and training and standards. I thought it was a little bit ironic that I started out in law enforcement without any training at all, and now I was responsible for a training and standards bureau. But fortunately for everybody, they've made great strides in that period of time. But again, it was a tremendous opportunity. The thing that faced the Department of Justice at that time was a tremendous backlog in DNA cases at the crime laboratory. Attorney General Van Hollen, I think, had made that a part of his campaign. I think everybody was concerned about the backlog. There just weren't the resources. But it had reached a point where the legislature would also recognize the need for increased resources in DNA. DNA was rapidly evolving, and the value of DNA in criminal investigations was extremely apparent. So the legislature approved, I think we had asked for 27 or 28 analysts, additional DNA analysts, and money to expand the crime laboratory. I think the legislature approved 26 of the 27 or 28 that we had asked for. I remember getting a call kind of in the middle of the night from a state representative or a state senator saying that, you know, we finally got those analysts approved and also the money to expand the crime laboratory. And everything just fell into place. A, we had a good staff. We had Jerry Gertz was the director of the Madison Lab.
Mike Camp.
Mike was in Wausau. And
I should remember that too.
It was a young lady in Milwaukee. Okay. Her name escapes me at the moment. But those were the three crime lab directors. Lou Wilsinski was the executive officer in training and standards. Everybody came together.
Dennis Hansen was the bureau director. Yep.
Everybody came together and focused on the need for the DNA expansion, and including the Department of Administration. It was the first time in my experience that the state completed a project on time, on budget. That lab was completed about the time the analysts were brought on board. And as luck would have it, there was a firm that was developing a training program for DNA analysts, and they were in the beginning stages. They offered us that training program at no cost. And so we were able to bring on 26 analysts, expand more than double the size of our DNA capabilities at the crime lab, and get them all trained and up and running in a very short period of time, and essentially eliminated that DNA backlog. But it was one of those times where everything just fell in place just nicely. I've been around a lot of times where things don't fall in place very nicely, but it was just a tremendous development.
And did you have a deputy administrator at that time?
Lou Wilsinski would have been as close to the deputy administrator. They didn't call him a deputy administrator, although we tried a couple of times to have that position upgraded, and it was subsequently upgraded after after I left. But Lou was on top of things, did an excellent job.
I agree. So there, you were there how long in that law enforcement services?
That was 4 years. I spent 4 years there. When I took the position, I agreed to serve a term. The elections were coming up. I, again, not having been involved in politics before, not real anxious to get involved again when the next election came up. I stayed through the end of that term, but I had asked.
And then who followed you, Tony Barthuli?
Yes.
Yeah, Tony Barthuli, retired chief from Fond du Lac.
Fond du Lac, yep.
Okay, so, and then you went to corrections. I'll say before you just touch on correction briefly, I'll have to say, Gary, going to corrections, to me, is number one, the most challenging cabinet position there is, just because of what it is, the size of it and the challenge. Number two, probably one of the more challenging positions you could have in the criminal justice system, and I include courts, law enforcement, and how long you were there as corrections secretary?
I served as corrections secretary for 2 years. I took that job in 2011, January 2011. In the latter part of 2011, my wife was diagnosed with a form of cancer. They had the recall of the governor took place. I believe that was in 2011. I didn't want to leave in the middle of a recall. Again, not that I was politically involved, but I just didn't think that was an appropriate thing to do. So I stayed until 2012. The recall had taken place unsuccessful recall had taken place. And then Susan was going through cancer, I had had prostate cancer when I was sheriff, and there were some signs that that might be coming back, and I decided that that was the time to leave. But it was before I left the Attorney General's office. It was probably a week or so before I was going to move out. I got a call from the transition team for Governor Walker asking if I would come down. They had a transition office on the lower level of the Justice Center, and asked if I would come down and talk to him. And I thought, well, they're doing a background on somebody. Sure, I'll go down and talk to him. And I went down, and they asked if I would consider the Secretary of the Department of Correction. I said, no, I'm not interested in that. You know, I had to kind of speculate. I had a friend that worked in corrections, and we had kind of speculated who the next secretary might be, and, you know, never did I think either his name or my name would come up. But they talked, and I had an interesting experience with a former inmate maybe a week or two prior to that that kind of influenced me. I think I'd walked out of the Justice Center on a very cold December day, and there was a fellow standing on the street by the bus stop, and he said, "Hey, Sheriff." And so I thought I'd go talk to him. I went and talked to him, and he said, "You don't know me," he says, "but I was in your jail when you were sheriff." And I said, showing you that I wasn't thinking of rehabilitation at all, I said, "It's probably a lot warmer there today than it is out here, you know." And he says, "Yeah," but he says, "I like it out here better." And he was telling me he hadn't had a drink for quite some time. He had a daughter graduating from college. He was able to send her a small amount of money for a graduation gift and stuff. He still had a brother that was in the prison system, but he was making a go of it. And that, after they asked about taking corrections, I said, "Well, I have to talk to my wife and stuff." I didn't give him an answer right away. But I got to thinking about it. I thought, well, you know, if there's a chance that you can turn one life around, maybe it's worth it. Maybe we'll give it a shot. So I got out a copy of the Blue Book and looked up the Department of Corrections, because I didn't know a whole lot about corrections from a sheriff's standpoint. The Department of Corrections wasn't always our friend, because they were housing probation and parole holds in our jail and driving up the jail population, and they had limited options, and sheriffs pushed back, and I was one of them. So I didn't have the highest regard for the Department of Corrections, but I thought, well, I'll look at it. And I pulled out the Blue Book, and the biennial budget was in the billions of dollars. I didn't know how many zeros were in a billion. And they had 10,000 employees. And I thought, well, that might be a little bit over my head. And So then I talked to a friend about it, and he thought, you know, maybe it would, it might be a good fit. So I ended up saying yes. And but I said that I would want to pick my own people to come into the Department of Corrections. I could pick a deputy secretary and an executive assistant. Could have picked a lot of others too, for that matter. But I was fortunate to pick Chuck Cole, who was a retired deputy chief of police in the Madison Police Department. I'd known Chuck for quite a number of years. Asked him to be deputy secretary, and he was working at corrections at the time. And he agreed to do that. And I knew that I needed somebody that knew something about numbers and details and stuff. And so I contacted Dennis Hsu, who was at the Office of Justice Assistance. And I'd worked with Dennis a number of times. And,
former DA.
Yep, from Juneau County. Yep. And so I contacted Dennis and asked if he would assist, and he agreed. So we had a good team in place, and the rest of them were division administrators and stuff that I could have appointed, but I had some excellent people already within the Department of Corrections that we just had stay in place. I think we moved maybe one or two around, but we had an excellent team of people. So it was I was fortunate.
You mentioned Chuck Cole. Chuck was from the school of, like you and I, Gary. He built his career off of trust.
Yep.
At Madison PD, and he held different positions over the years, like task force
yep.
for drugs. He was well respected by law enforcement
yep.
throughout the state.
He was respected by everyone.
God rest his soul.
I met Chuck first time when I was director of the Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs Bureau, and he was a leader of the drug task force in Madison and Dane County. And so I got to know Chuck from that time forward. We ended up being neighbors. But you're right. He had the respect. That, again, that's relationships. At the Department of Corrections, he was responsible for PREA investigations, prison, I can't remember exactly, prison sexual assault cases, and had developed an excellent relationship with wardens and staff throughout the state and throughout the department. So that just made it a lot easier.
For some of our younger listeners, to give you a perspective of what corrections changed both in the state of Wisconsin and nationwide. When I started in 79 in law enforcement, it was called the Bureau of Prisons mm-hmm. in the Department of Health.
Yep.
It was a bureau level size. Now, there were several hundred, obviously, employees there, mm-hmm. but in a Department of Health, and you tell that to some people in corrections today, that's impossible.
Yep.
You can't have 10,000 people in a multi-billion-dollar budget as a full department, and it has a bureau. In 1979 and 80,
yep.
yes, it was a bureau.
The Bureau of Prison Health and Social Services, the late Tim Cullen, former state senator who just passed away over Christmas, was head of the Department of Health and Human Services. At the time, it was a Bureau of Prisons. Yep.
So, Gary, a couple of follow-up questions here. We discussed a couple of high-profile, unusual cases. Any other high-profile or cases that come to mind that you wanted to briefly speak about that stick out in your memory?
I mean, certainly the Anthony Raymond case was one that just finding Anthony Raymond brought a great deal of satisfaction. That and the relationships with tribal government, I think, are the things that I'm perhaps most proud of. I had a lot of friendships, a lot of positive relationships. Certainly the death investigation school was something that I was extremely proud of. Had a chance to go back to my hometown of Hayward on a murder case, and we were able to successfully solve that. That was, was happy to be able to do that. Every assignment brought something of value. You know, we joked white collar crime. It was the Organized Crime Bureau, and then it became the White Collar Crime Bureau. If you're a cop and enjoy action or being involved in things, white collar crime sometimes doesn't have that appeal. You're sitting there going through records and.
Now, Gary, come on. I was told when I went into white collar, you were going to replace your weapon in your shoulder holster with a
notary seal.
A notary seal, yes.
Yeah. But one of my most satisfying moments came in the White Collar Crime Bureau when we were investigating some organized crime figures, but we had one fellow who was a banker for a large bank in Milwaukee. And they have correspondent relationships with smaller banks around the state at the time. I had no idea how banking worked. But this fellow was getting kickbacks for making loans, and he would route the kickbacks through a variety of correspondent banks. And we had some idea what he was doing, and I developed a source within a bank that would explain the banking system to me. And we had a John Doe investigation going on, and so I was able to get subpoenas on a regular basis. But we were able, one step at a time, to make a subpoena to one bank and then find out where some money came from, and then we go to another bank. And we ended up charging and convicting the guy of taking kickbacks. But I'll never forget the elation, I think, when I got that last subpoena that linked this whole thing right back to his account. And that gave me a great deal of satisfaction because, I was a guy that had a hard time balancing, my wife will tell you, I had a hard time balancing the checkbook. To be able to catch a banker doing something like that in his own area was immensely satisfying. It wasn't a monumental case or anything else, but it kind of showed me that if you developed relationships because you had a relationship with the banker that kind of helped me do that. And, if you set your mind to it, you can learn anything. And while that was just going through records and microfilm and stuff, we were able to piece it all together and he was charged and convicted. So that was white collar crime, organized crime. We had one, I had a fellow who was reputed to be a hitman for organized crime. We had a subpoena for him. Couldn't find him. This was back when we still used our own cars with no radios. Well, his home happened to be between our state office in downtown Milwaukee, and I lived at that time on the northwest side of Milwaukee, and so when I went home, I would drive by his place to see if he was around. And one day, I saw him a few blocks from his house, and so I jumped out of the car and was going to give him the subpoena. Well, at that time, you mentioned my handlebar mustache. We had a little altercation in an alley when he threatened to twist it around my neck. And fortunately for me, two guys in a car drove by the end of the alley about the same time. I honestly believe they were two FBI agents doing a surveillance as well. But he thought that was my backup, and that made him turn and run instead of twisting my mustache around my neck. But it was, again, that's one of those where you're out there by yourself, no radio contact, nobody knows where you were. I mean, if I'd been beaten to death in the alley, nobody would have known I was there. It was probably 20/20 hindsight wasn't the smart thing to do, but each assignment had its own little quirks, I think.
Before I finish up with a couple of questions to kind of sum things up, just a list again of the attorney generals you worked for. First would have been Bronson.
Bronson and Follett was attorney general when I was hired, I think.
Yeah, he was there in 1980 when I was hired.
Was he? Okay. And then Bob Warren?
Bob Warren would have been, yeah, you're right.
Bronson
came back.
Bronson came back,
That's
yeah.
That's right. Go ahead.
So I think Bronson was there when I was hired. Mm-hmm. He was probably there when I started in November. It may have been a November election that he lost. And then Bob Warren became the attorney general. And then Bronson did come back.
Bob Warren became
federal judge in Milwaukee.
Federal judge,
yep. Then Bronson came back. Don Hanaway defeated Bronson in an election. Jim Doyle came after Don Hanaway, and then Jim was still the attorney general when I left to become sheriff.
Yep, and then under J.B. Van Hollen came back.
Yep, came back. J.B.
I had a great side story. Gary was probably corrections at the time. No, wouldn't be. It would have been law enforcement services. We had the sheriff's conference, mm-hmm. a winter conference up in maybe it was the summer in Minocqua, mm-hmm. and we were at a hospitality room, and probably 30, 40 people mm-hmm. in a pretty crowded room. Down the hallway, kind of poking their nose in, was Bronson the Follett.
Oh, yeah.
And long since retired, he looked to me, looked the same. You recognized him, I recognized him. He recognized you. He didn't, didn't remember me. We sat down. He, no one else in the room knew who he was. You and I had the greatest conversation with him that night. It was fantastic. Yeah. And it was just one of those things where, there again, history. I mean, to listen to Bronson tell some of the stories about some crazy things that occurred in the 60s and 70s as he was attorney general. It was a really special night. I was glad I was there with you.
I think One of the things I've come to understand, I think, over time is that, the Attorney General, I think that position's under a lot more stress than, you know, if you're working as an agent in DCI or anyplace else and you see, you know, well, that's the Attorney General, that's the boss. I think those are very stressful positions. We had that conversation with Bronson. I had a conversation with Attorney General Hanaway. He lost the election to Jim Doyle, and I had a conversation with him after he lost that election.
And he became a circuit judge in Brown County.
Brown County. But he was much more relaxed. It was probably the nicest conversation I'd ever, you know, I'd had a number of conversations with him. I met him a lot of times, but it was probably the nicest conversation.
Yes.
I think it was the fact that you know, the pressure's gone. Not in that case, it was because of a defeat.
10-year office.
Yep. So I think, those are stressful positions. We don't often give them credit for the...
I had the same experience with Don Hanaway. I had him on a search warrant mm-hmm. when I was in later. It was a total different
yep.
comfort level and yep. stress level as a circuit judge.
Yep.
So a couple of follow-ups, and they're kind of connected. The first one is the most enjoyable part or time of your career, followed up by what are you most proud about in your career? And I know you mentioned gaming about it, but starting with the most enjoyable time in your career.
I think the most enjoyable time for me was my time in the Milwaukee DCI office. We had a great group of people there that when there was work to be done 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, if you needed to do it. If there was fun to be had, we had office picnics every summer.
Softball games.
We had guys that had a sense of humor, practical jokes.
Great Christmas parties.
Yep.
I was down there.
Yep. It was a great place to work. It was a fun place to work. I was never sure how I would fit into Milwaukee. Coming from Hayward, going to Milwaukee isn't exactly an easy move necessarily, but tremendous people. Dale Lane, a number of people came from Milwaukee Police Department, other guys down there, Harry Engelbart when I first went down there, Walter Yonk and,
yep.
and Al Sir, two retired military guys that had a wealth of experience, were great mentors, just a great group of people to work with. That
would have been the same time you were teaching at the Death Investigation School, correct?
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. I said the same thing during my interview, those 6 years in special assignments, and that time it was Rick Luell was my partner,
yep.
Liz
yep.
Feagles, and the Death Investigation School was a very enjoyable time in my career. So
yep.
That area of your career you were most proud of?
I think it's the relationships that I built over time and the trust that I could create. I remember being in a northern county where, again, state agents, as I mentioned before, weren't welcome, and the chief deputy, we were going to get a search warrant, and the chief deputy had to go in and explain to the judge that even though I was from DCI and from the state, that I was there to help on this murder case and that it would be okay to issue a search warrant. And we went from that to a very good working relationship. So just those relationships and being able to develop that trust, I think that's what I'm most proud of.
Well, thank you, Gary. I'm going to allow just one more opportunity for any closing comments, any closing thoughts, anything we didn't cover.
No, the one thing I can say is I'm extremely proud of having been a part of DCI. I spent 29 years in DCI. It was it far exceeded anything I had ever expected out of a law enforcement career, and I was there in the, I guess maybe what you call some of the primitive days when we used our own cars and citizen band radios to, the technology certainly isn't where it is today, but it got a little bit easier. When we did a wiretap, I remember back in the, it would have been in the 70s, you had to set up the wiretap in the same prefix area that of the number that you were tapping. And our apartment happened to be in that same prefix area, so I was working undercover as a cab driver, and my wife was teaching, and in the morning, and we had just gotten to know the neighbors, lived in an apartment, just gotten to know the neighbors, and then we got this assignment. So I would leave in the morning with my cab driver's hat. Shortly after I left, two guys in suits would come in, then my wife would leave, and then at the end of the day, my wife would come home from teaching, the two guys in the suits would leave, And then I'd come home sometime later at night. And, it was just, those were different times. They were fun times. But I was proud of that. And the other thing I think that I enjoyed about DCI and that I think helped me in throughout my career was the close working relationship we had with attorneys in the Department of Justice. In my time there, we had some top-notch criminal prosecution attorneys. Mike Zaleski, Peter Peszek, some guys that did a tremendous job, and I learned a tremendous amount from them and really appreciated the opportunity to work closely with
Steve Eber, Doug Eber,
Steve Morgan. They were, it was really a privilege to work with them and to learn from them. And it made me that much more confident when you're, stuck out on a remote county by yourself and have to make decisions and just understanding the law and the legal parts. It came back to help me as sheriff of Dane County. We had a case where a fellow had committed a triple homicide, and he was from Taiwan, was on his way after the homicide, flew to New York, and he had a flight booked to Taiwan. We don't have an extradition treaty with Taiwan. If he got it that far, he was gone. Our detectives went out and found him in New York, and we were looking rapidly to see if there was some way to detain him because we didn't have enough to charge him at the time. But we certainly thought that he was involved. From years ago in DCI, I remember researching extradition. And I saw that there was something called the uniform extradition of a material witness. Never used it or anything. I just remember seeing that heading in the statutes. And so when we were searching for a way to bring him back, I mentioned to the district attorney, I said, I know there's something in there. It was the DA and a couple of assistants and our people. I said, there's something about a uniform extradition of a material witness. And sure enough, they looked it up, found it. It had never been used in Wisconsin, and you had to have a grand jury impaneled to get the subpoena. I think in a matter of hours, they got a judge to sign a grand jury order, and we convened a grand jury, got the subpoena, got it to New York. Our detectives were still there, took the guy into custody on a uniform extradition of material witness warrant, I guess you would call it, brought him back to Madison. We couldn't put him in jail because he wasn't arrested, so we made sure he had a secure, safe room at a hotel, and we didn't want him going out on the street for fear something might happen, so we made sure that we had deputies there. In the meantime, we developed enough to charge him, but with the uniform extradition of a material witness, you can't bring somebody back on a material witness warrant and then arrest them. So we flew him back to New York, and he was arrested by multiple detectives from the New York Port Authority, the New York Police Department, and with the assistance of a couple of Dane County deputies. But I bring that up only because working with our attorneys, having gone through extradition proceedings with them, having gone through grand jury proceedings, John Doe proceedings, and those things, I was familiar with the law. And had I not had that experience, I wouldn't have been that familiar with it. And that sort of thing wouldn't have happened, or at least I wouldn't have had a part in it.
Well put, Gary. Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed this. I think our listeners will too. And for our listeners, again, to remind you, we plan on doing some of these podcasts every few weeks with anyone who's willing to volunteer their time, both sworn and non-sworn, and including some current staff if there's anybody's interested. And maybe over the next year or two, every few weeks, we can do one of these for an hour to 2 hours in length and really document not only the history and the careers at DCI, again, both sworn and non-sworn, but to share that with our current and retired employees and sort of get a record of just some of the work, especially the people from Gary's era that actually established this organization, were actually at the ground floor and laid some of the foundations that we're so fortunate that are in place today. So thank you, Gary.
Thank you.